Welcome to the local news roundup on The Point. I'm your host, Sean Corcoran. We're going to be rounding up some of the top local news stories of the week with some of our region's top journalists. And with me in the studio are two of them. Jeff Spillane is here from the Cape Cod Times. Hello, Jeff.
Hey, good morning, Sean.
Good morning to you. Sam Houghton is here from the Mashpee Enterprise and Enterprise Newspapers. Hello,
morning.
Sam.
Morning, Sean.
Thanks for joining us. We'll also speak with Sarah Brown from the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle, Jim Deruta from the New Bedford Standard Times, Ann Wood from the Provincetown Banner, and Barry Stringfellow from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Let's start with the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station. Some word, not much, but some word from federal regulators on the power station and where it stands. Jeff Spillane, so this has been ranked at the very bottom, just close to being shut down by the feds, and will that change?
No, you know what, Sean? Not a lot of surprise here, but the Nuclear Regulatory Commission issued its 2016 assessment of the Pilgrim performance. Once again, it's still near the bottom, one of the three worst performers in the United States, one step above forced shutdown. Regulatory Commission did say that they still are not taking a possible shutdown off the table. They're going to continue to monitor the situation. Something here that was very interesting that they did find in the assessment, we did know about this. They called it an issue that was associated with willfulness and impeding the regulatory process. And that was back in 2014, a security officer deliberately skipped 200 required fire watches at the plant, and that was when the fire suppression system was down. So you can imagine the disaster that could have come out of that.
Oh, yeah. And he doctored the documents and such to cover his tracks. It was alleged anyway, and he lost his job.
Yeah, he did lose his job. And big day coming up here for everyone that does pay attention to what's going on in Pilgrim. It's March 21st. And that's going to be in Plymouth at Memorial Hall, where the 2016 assessment will be discussed. There's also going to be a discussion of the special plant inspection that was held back in December and January, where 20 experts from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and other agencies came to Plymouth and went through the plant with a fine-tooth comb. And from what we understand, 10 to 15 deficiencies were found. So March 21st could be a very interesting meeting in Plymouth.
They're still looking to shut down in 2019 as far as we know?
Yeah,
May 2019. Okay, well, I'm sure we'll continue to hear more about the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station. How about the Wildlife Center? This was a place here on the Cape where you could take an injured wild animal, and that was going to shut down, right?
Right, yeah. This is the Cape Cod Wildlife Center in Barnstable on Route 6A. Last October, the Humane Society of the United States announced it was going to be closing the Cape Wildlife Center, the only center we have here on the Cape for larger animals. There is an organization called Wildcare in East Ham, which handles birds, small birds, chipmunks. Cape Cod Wildlife Center, really the only facility where you can work with coyotes and otter, larger animals.
Yeah.
Really inspired a lot of local organizations and foundations to spring into action. And I spoke to some, when this first happened, to some animal control officers who said they just didn't know what they were going to do without this facility. They take injured animals and bring them over there, and they're treated right there in Barnstable. If they had to do that, they'd have to go up, if it closed, they'd have to go up to Norwell, and likely they'd lose a lot of their patients on Route 3 heading up there. So it was a temporary fix to the situation where a group did get some money to keep it open until March, and now this week we learn much longer-term solution has been found to keep it open for the next 2 years. It's going to be a combination of the Friends of the Cape Wildlife Center, which was founded after the potential closure, and the New England Wildlife Center, which is in Weymouth. So they'll be sending down a veterinarian here 4 days a week, new vet techs, and it's going to stay open. It's going to be a more grassroots approach, they say. So over the course of the next 2 years, they're going to be doing a lot more community outreach to talk about the importance of this facility.
And they're saying 2 years open, could be longer, but that's because of a lease with the Humane Society?
That's right. I believe they're leasing it for $2 or
per year. I think it was $2. Yeah.
Right. Fairly
reasonable for Cape Cod.
Very nice. Very nice of the Humane Society to allow that. So
Sam,
hopefully it'll be much longer.
Let's bring Sam Houghton into the conversation from the Mashpee Enterprise. Sam, you have a story this week about new Seabury and some landowners in Mashpee. So New Seaberry is it's a development area of Mashpee. Is that how we would describe it? Close to the water?
Yeah. So this issue is actually just three homeowners that live in New Seaberry. Their home is slowly, their backyards are slowly going into Nantucket Sound. They live on kind of a 30-foot bank, and they have, well, they 2 years ago, they proposed this system that people call it a soft solution. It basically, we'll stop erosion, but at the same time being within state regulations. 2 years ago, they passed that through the Conservation Commission in Mashpee and some neighbors to it appealed the decision. That went to Mass Department of Environmental Protection for a hearing, which they also approved it. And then that was again appealed, which brings us to kind of another section of Mass DEP, which is more of like it's not technically a court hearing, but it has more testimony under oath and such. Which kind of leads us to what's happened recently. A officer basically recommended to the head of the DEP to reject this. Attorneys on both sides are saying that this is really the first time this has kind of happened. It has some potential ramifications across the entire coast, which is why you had 36 state legislators get in there and say, you know, to the commissioner of DEP, like you can't accept this recommendation to reject this, because I guess let me back up and say this comes from the 1978 Water Wetlands Protection Act, which basically said if your home was built after 1978 when the act was passed, you can't have some kind of revetment. Such as jetty or rock wall, because but
that's not what they're talking about here. What do you mean? What are exactly do they want to do to protect their property? What's this soft protection?
Right. So a soft solution, they're saying it's not a revetment or an engineered structure is what they call it, quote unquote. It will allow a wave to come in, displace the sand, but at the same time, so it protects the coast, but at the same time does not cause erosion down the line.
That's install something under the sand?
Yes, so there's core fiber rolls. They have kind of timber pilings up in front, which is kind of the interesting discussion. The attorney for the appellants here is saying this is an engineered structure. This isn't, you know, quote unquote, soft solution. So for a long time, this attorney is saying is that MassDEP has allowed these soft solutions to creep more and more, to evolve more and more, to become these hard structures.
Oh.
And he's saying, you know, where do you draw the line? And he's saying this is the case where you draw the line. He's saying this is the first time this has ever gotten this far. And this kind of judiciary attorney, basically, in MassDEP is saying it might be good public policy to allow this kind of soft structure, but in the regulations of the Wetlands Protection Act, you can't have this.
Hmm.
So that's why the commissioner, he's in a tight spot. I mean, does he follow the regulations and, you know, not allow homes that are really on the coast, you know, with climate change now, further erosion, you know, do we not allow this and potentially have more homes going into the ocean?
So we're in the midst of a process with the Massachusetts Department of the Environmental Protection. And if, depending what happens there, this could go back to the courts, right?
It could. Right. That's one thing. I don't know how far both sides are willing to take it, but if the commissioner, either way he rules, they could go to the Superior Court, the state Superior Court. Well, people are saying, you know, depending on the outcome or regardless of the outcome, maybe the regulations of the Wetland Protection Act need to be changed, which I think is the kind of the interesting topic here.
So there's ways to go with this story.
Yeah, I think so.
All right. Sam Houghton, the Mashpee Enterprise. Thank you for that, Sam. Let's go to the phone where Sarah Brown is joining us from the Vineyard Gazette. Hello, Sarah.
Good morning, Sean.
Good morning to you. So Chilmark, I understand, has a new police chief. Let's start with that before we talk about the island's newest residents.
Mm-hmm.
So, new police chief.
Yeah, new police chief, a new face among the six island chiefs of police. And Chilmark, last night, the Board of Selectmen voted unanimously to appoint current Chilmark Sergeant Jonathan Claren to the position of chief. He's been with the department, I think, since 1989. He started as a summer officer, and then he joined the department permanently in 1996. So he's been there for a while, knows the department, knows the town and the island. And he steps in to replace former Chief Brian Chofi, who resigned in December. And there's been a search committee since then working on finding a new chief. And I think there are 13 applicants, just two from the island. And then it was down to three finalists. It was Seekonk Captain Frank John, a Plymouth Police Captain Bruce McDamey, and then Sergeant Claren. And they were interviewed Wednesday with, you know, the questions for the off-island candidates, kind of focusing on challenges of transitioning to the Vineyard and policing that here. But Sergeant Claren's questions really focused on, you know, more town-specific issues, working. He said he wants to work on a sense of uncertainty in the department after the former chief left, you know, steps to strengthen the department. And the board seemed to really think that, you know, he knows the island, they know him, and they liked the way that he could move the department forward. So he will, he's the newest chief.
Okay, congratulations to him. And and to this next story, the rivalry between Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard continues. And the Vineyard is taking the lead right now with John. Well, I'll let you give the announcement.
Yeah, the charms of the Vineyard seem to have lured former Secretary of State and former Senator John Kerry from Nantucket to here. He purchased a home this week on the island. The sale went through on Monday. It's in Chilmark, right on the water, kind of the north shore of the island with a view of the Elizabeth Islands. It's in the private Seven Gates farm area, and the property is about 18 and a half acres, and the sale price was $11.75 million, I believe. And it's a pretty historic house. It's one of the original sites that founded Seven Gates Farm in the late 1800s. I think the house dates back to about 1924, and it's a really beautiful property. It's pretty secluded, pretty, you know, in a rural area and pretty right on the water there. And as you mentioned, you know, he has long owned a summer house on Brant Point, near Brant Point in Nantucket, and that's where he and his wife, Teresa Hines, were married. And I'm sure the Enquirer and Mirror has been reporting that that property's been on the market since last spring. So it seems that they have they've hopped on over to this island, at least for their summer visits.
Okay, the Carries on Martha's Vineyard. Sarah Brown of the Vineyard Gazette. Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll speak with Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Welcome back to the local news roundup on The Point here on WCAI. I'm Sean Corcoran, and with me in our Woods Hole studio is Jeff Spillane from the Cape Cod Times. But let's go to the phone where Tim Wood is joining us from the Cape Cod Chronicle newsroom in Chatham. Hello, Tim.
Hi there, Sean.
Tim, I understand the Chatham Chamber of Commerce is looking for a significant hike in the amount of money, amount of funding it gets from the town of Chatham, right?
Yes, indeed. The Chamber's requesting a $13,000 increase in funding from the town at the upcoming town meeting. They're asking for a total of $75,000. This is a little less than half of this increase is slated to go towards increasing the salary of staff at the visitors centers during the summer. But a good chunk of it, $7,000, is going to be targeted at marketing and quote-unquote branding of the town, according to Chamber Executive Lise Franz. Now, that's a pretty much a catchword now. I'm not sure quite what they're going to be doing towards that. But how Chatham wants to be seen by the outside world, particularly visitors and even potential residents, it's been a topic of conversation among several boards and committees, including the Board of Selectmen. Last year, they heard from some folks who were concerned that the association of the town with great white sharks, you know, found on our waters in bigger and bigger numbers, could be harmful to the town's reputation and its brand, if you will. The Chamber met with some marketing people earlier in the year, and they're in discussions with the town's Economic Development Committee to see what direction they could go here. Now, Lisa Franz said that the events that the chamber produces throughout the year, the chamber and the Merchants Association, which is a subgroup of the chamber, such as Sharks in the Park and Christmas by the Sea, as well as other promotional activities, bring thousands of people into town and are a major contributor to continued increases in revenue to the town from the meals and the rooms tax. Last year, that brought in more than $1.7 million to the town. Selectmen aren't sure that they completely buy that tie-in, but they are willing to ask for that extra money from voters at the May 8th town meeting, so they approved that inclusion of that in the budget. But they also asked the chamber to develop some metrics to try to show how their activities and this specifically this funding will help in developing more tax revenue for the town and more increase in interest and sort of towards the sort of good reputation side for Chatham.
Okay. Well, we'll watch to see what happens at town meeting with that. And how about the Harwich Middle School? They have there's a proposal on the table to open a new cultural history center there.
Indeed. Right now, the middle school is vacant. It's been vacant since the Monomoy school merger. It's a big building. They're renting some space out right now to local artists as studio space. But they have gotten an idea proposal for a potential major tenant in the form of a Cape Verdean Cultural Center. Two local residents, Barbara Burgo and Jane Texiera Henry, brought this idea to the Board of Selectmen earlier this week. Now, the two curated a Cape Verdean exhibit at the Harwich Historical Society at the Brooks Academy Museum in 2012, and it got positive reviews in town. And they said it showed a lot of interest in Cape Verdean culture and history, and they'd like to have a permanent facility to spotlight this heritage. Now, Harwich has one of the largest, if not the largest, Cape Verdean population on the Cape, and it's really intertwined. The Cape Verdean community is really intertwined with Harwich, going back, 100 years or more. And Cape Verdeans have been key players in town and government, and schools, and other institutions. Mm-hmm. Now, details of what this cultural center might look like are still being formulated. The selectmen were really behind this idea, however, and they asked town administrator Chris Clark and community center director Carolyn Carey to begin working out the details with Burgo and Texiera Henry. So hopefully we'll see that coming forward fairly soon.
Okay, Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle filling us in. Thanks, Tim.
Thanks for having me, Sean.
Oh, of course. Anytime. Jeff Blaine is here from the Cape Cod Times. Jeff, you went out with someone we're calling the Cape's Needle Hunter. At least that's what the headline called her. And this is a woman who is out there pretty much, every day picking up hypodermic needles?
Every day, yes. Her name is Kim Power. She's a harm reduction specialist for the AIDS Support Group of Cape Cod. And since late 2015, Sean, the AIDS Support Group of Cape Cod and the town of Barnstable have been involved in a court case. The AIDS Support Group of Cape Cod provides a free needle access program out of their office on Sell Street. The town really says, you can't do that without our approval. It's currently in the hands of the Mass Supreme Judicial Court. Should be a verdict in the next 3 months. In the meantime, this has been going on for the past year. A judge in Barnstable Superior Court said, hey, until this is resolved, you need to make sure to the AIDS Support Group that needles aren't being left around the area, that they're not a neighbor's property, that they're not providing an issue with the school children who go by there. So Kim Powers, this woman here at the AIDS Support Group of Cape Cod, goes out every morning looking for needles. She combs the area around the South Street location of the office and then expands her walk through town. And I did go on one with her this past week. She goes through what she calls all the hot spots in town. They're the transportation center, areas around North Street, the comfort stations in town, abandoned homes. And really what her big part of her mission is not only picking up the needles, which she says a lot of the needles she picks up aren't even the ones that they distribute.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The ones that they distribute have a distinctive orange cap that we were looking for. So she picks them all up if she finds one. But part of her mission is to not only find the needles, but find the people who are using the needles, try to bring them in for treatment, at least get them in to the AIDS Support Group of Cape Cod for testing for hepatitis C or HIV. And also another big part of what she does, picking up the needles, is not only to prevent UI or children or any other pedestrian from stepping on them. But also there's a problem with users picking up these dirty needles and using them again.
Right.
And hepatitis C can live inside a syringe for 60 days, the virus, and HIV for 28 days. So she is out there. She's doing a terrific job. It says that she actually brings in more needles than they distribute.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
And I know last summer they had installed in the restrooms in Hyannis, mm-hmm. A sharps boxes in those restrooms. And she was saying that's where a lot of people go to use drugs. And then you also have a quote in there. You talk to someone, the DPW official who empties those boxes, saying they're seeing less needles in there.
They are. They have the sharps containers in these public restrooms that the town has, and they're seeing less. I think that it might be, it could be the Kim is doing such a great job, but it could also be that there's more people seeking treatment in the Hyannis area, which would be a great sign.
Yeah, let's hope that's the case.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's go to the phone. Jim DeRude is joining us from the New Bedford Standard Times newsroom. Hello, Jim.
Good morning, Sean.
Good morning to you. We've been speaking about a new chancellor coming to UMass Dartmouth, and finally that new chancellor has been named.
Yep, he was announced this week by UMass President Marty Meehan. The new chancellor of UMass Dartmouth is Robert E. Johnson. He was the Massachusetts candidate of the three for the position. He comes from Becker College, which is in Central Mass, has two campuses, about 2,200 students. He has a long career as an administrator. I think he's from Detroit originally. He's going to be UMass Dartmouth's first black chancellor. He's worked at schools in Ohio, I believe Michigan, and Worcester.
And there have been some racial concerns on the campus, hasn't there, in recent years?
Yeah. So year and a half ago, there was a group that was denied a campus African American group that was denied some access at a local event center type thing. It really did come down to it having some racial overtones to their denial, but the campus responded quite quickly under its previous full-time chancellor, Davina Grossman. They were very proactive, did the right things to move on that. Yeah.
Well, let's move on to another story we've been following. Carlos Rafael, who most of us know as the Codfather, there's been some progress in his case.
There is.
Give us the background, of course.
Okay, yeah. So Carlos owns about 40 fishing boats between scallops and ground fish between New Bedford and Gloucester. Most of them are in New Bedford. He got a little kicked off at the state a couple years ago and said, I'm just going to sell all my stuff and I'm going to sell it to somebody who won't even use Massachusetts. It's really what he literally said.
Right.
Well, when he tried to sell it, his two big clients were IRS agents undercover posing as Russian businessmen. And he apparently spilled the beans on the whole operation to help them understand how they could make money. And what he was doing, of course, was the government alleges that he caught some 40 tons of fish, mislabeled what they were, didn't say that he was catching quota regimented fish, and was just saying he was catching plentiful stuff. And then he was selling it for cash, for huge bags of cash with a New York fish seller.
Huh. Maybe they should call him the Skate Father rather than the Cod Father, because he was taking skate and calling it haddock, or alleged, of course. But he's going to, the reporting this week is he'll be pleading guilty?
That's right. The U.S. attorney announced that he's going to plead guilty. 25 counts of lying to federal fishing regulators, a count of bulk cash smuggling, count of conspiracy, and he was using a correctional officer from Bristol County who got a Homeland Security position up at Logan, and he was helping to get the bags of cash around inspections and out of the country into Portugal.
Any idea of the penalty that Mr. Raphael will face?
Well, if he, I think he's pleading out away from charges on of like mislabeling, and so that's going to make things easier. And those, he would have forfeited his entire fleet for things like that. But we haven't heard. I mean, I heard a rumor from somebody who's in the who follows these fishing things. It thinks he'll serve time. We don't know. We'll have to see. It'll be next week. He'll be before the judge to determine penalties.
So perhaps we'll talk about this again next Friday.
On Could the
roundup. Be. Okay. Jim Deruda of the New Bedford Standard Times filling us in. Thank you, Jim.
Thanks, Sean.
Okay. Jeff Spillane is here from the Cape Cod Times. Jeff, there's been a movement. Well, it's been across the country, of course, but here in our backyard, there have been several communities that are taking a look at the immigrants that live in their communities and saying, how can we protect them from federal immigration law enforcement? Of course, these are different proposals. One came up in Harwich. You know, so residents are trying in some cases to bring something to town meeting to say, hey, let's not have local police doing federal immigration enforcement. And that was what was proposed in Harwich, right?
That's right. In the form of a petition article, Sean, that was put before the Harwich Board of Selectmen on Monday night. This particular petition, which there are several, by the way, as you mentioned, that are being proposed in the mid to lower Cape towns right now, that asked the would ask town meeting to prohibit town officials from using town money or resources to enforce federal immigration laws unless there was a criminal reason, a criminal warrant. The article was struck down by the Board of Selectmen, will not be on the warrant for town meeting, primarily because the board did not support it. One of the selectmen said, you know, we'll be asking our police chief not to enforce our laws. Should also add there was no public comment during this meeting.
Oh, not allowed, or it just was none?
Not allowed. It wasn't. There was just not. It wasn't allowed.
Wow.
Yeah. There would. I'm sure there would have been quite a bit. and so the Harwich police chief said that, you know, in 30 years being involved with the police department in Harwich, they have never been contacted by ICE. He said, "Yeah, we're stuck in the middle here. We're doing the same thing as a petition asks for now. You know, they would only." Talk with someone regarding their immigration status if it was a criminal warrant. And he said, you know, I'd feel uncomfortable to be asked to ignore a federal law. And there's also a little bit of fear in these towns, Sean, that President Trump has said, if you take on some of these positions or become a sanctuary city, you might lose all your federal funds.
But typically local police don't enforce federal law.
I mean,
right. So, okay. All right. Well, that's the decision the selectmen made.
Yeah.
Maybe if there was some public comment, we'd have better understanding about their reasoning.
Mm-hmm.
But in any case, let's go to the phone. Ann Wood is joining us. Well, actually, we'll hold off on Ann Wood. She'll be joining us very soon. Let's talk about the seashore. And some people are happy. A very specialized group of recreational kite surfers are happy of some news coming out of the National Seashore.
Yeah, they got some good news this week, Sean. These some folks who kite surf along the National Seashore. Kite surfing had been banned along the seashore coast. But starting next week on March 15th, there'll be 1 3/4 miles of seashore in Eastham that will be opened up for the sport. It had been banned on the oceanfront as well as in Cape Cod Bay, except for a little spot in Wellfleet called Duck Harbor. And this was a result of a lawsuit that was filed by an avid kite surfer. Who said there was no scientific backing as to why they couldn't do it, and they showed some bias against kite surfers. National Seashore, park rangers said the reason why they had these restrictions was to help protect the nesting and migration of shorebirds. So this area that they have now opened up to kite surfing is narrow enough where they think it will not affect any of the shorebirds or their nesting.
Still a lawsuit pending, though.
Still a lawsuit pending. They would like to have some more oceanfront acreage, to put it, for mm-hmm. more kite surfing.
And a new superintendent coming in to the National
That's
Seashore
right.
who could have a different take on kite
exactly.
surfing.
Exactly.
Okay. Let's take a quick break. And when we come back, of course, Jeff Spillane is going to stick around to keep talking about some stories out of the Cape Cod Times this week. And Ann Wood will join us from the Provincetown Banner. We'll also speak with Barry Stringfellow from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Welcome back to the local news roundup on The Point here on WCAI. I'm your host, Sean Corcoran. With me is Jeff Spillane from the Cape Cod Times. Jeff, let's go back to a story we were just talking about a moment or two ago, the Harwich Board of Selectmen taking on this citizen petition article that they want to see at town meeting about not enforcing federal immigration law. So let's just be clear on what the selectmen decided
there. Yeah, it was the selectmen did not by any means quash this immigration question from being at town meeting. They just recommended that town meeting indefinitely postpone this.
Okay.
So I guess it still will be up to the voters at Harwich Town Meeting.
And this is typical. Usually every mm-hmm. petition article goes in front of the selectmen or sometimes even the finance committee to get their take
That's
on
right.
it. Do you like it? Do you support it? Do you not? Do you think, you know, what do you think voters should do? I guess it's just a way to help guide voters from
exactly.
officials who have a
You'll
little
see insight. It in your little guide that you get in the mail. Yep.
Okay, let's go to the phone. Ann Wood is joining us from the Provincetown Banner. Hello, Ann.
Hey, Sean. Hi, Jeff. How you doing?
We're well. Thank you very much. Good morning. And so let's bring us up to date on what's happening with the Wellfleet Shellfish Constable. This has been an ongoing story here.
It has. Andy Koch, who's the Wellfleet Shellfish Constable for the last 13 years, and Wellfleet's the biggest shellfish town on Cape Cod, was having problems, apparently, because his contract was up to expire on December 31st of last year. And rather than renew it, the selectman gave him a two-month extension and invited him to meet in a closed session where they could talk about the problems that they were hearing about him. He didn't show up for that, and they decided, we found out later in executive session minutes, which are secret session minutes that the selectman eventually decided to release, that they decided to fire him that evening. Now, firing apparently, not renewing a contract is apparently the same thing as firing. And because he's a town employee, he was able to grab an attorney from the Wellfleet Employees Association, a union, who came in there with him and sort of talked to the selectman, saying that he was illegally fired.
I thought he resigned.
He did. We heard last that he submitted a letter of resignation, but apparently, I'm not really sure about the dates, but it sounds like that came after this agreement with the selectman that with this lawyer, they decided that he was going to get paid more than $74,000 a year with benefits through the end of December because of this firing. Apparently, so I don't really understand either where this whole thing with the letter of resignation that Dan Hort, the town administrator, said he got from Koch. Maybe that was the reason that part of the settlement deal so that he couldn't sue the town for being fired for apparently supposedly no reason because the last town administrator had written down nothing about any complaints about him.
Huh. It just seems strange because all the quotes I read from him are, I don't want to, you know, he didn't seem to want to do the job anymore.
It's very strange. It's really hard to know what's going on in somebody else's head, but it kind of lets me want a town job because apparently
okay.
you can quit or get fired and still make some money.
Well, I don't know about all that. Okay, let's
move on.
It
seems to be happening. At least in Wellfleet it did, so I don't know.
Well, maybe more will come out because, $74,000, that's a year of a teacher. I mean,
Yeah, that's his yearly salary, and he got it through the end of the year, even though he hasn't worked since February 28th.
Okay, let's move on because I'm just confused by that. So
I am confused by that too.
Right. The East End Market in Provincetown, they're going through a permitting process. What did you find out there?
The East End Market in Provincetown actually is going through a permitting process and was granted by the Board of Selectmen economic development permit, which allows it to increase its Title V flow and with it means that it can add 4 employee dormitory style bedrooms upstairs in the space that's used for storage, a bathroom, and a kitchenette. This marketplace is only the second place in town to have official dormitory-style housing for employees, which is greatly needed in Provincetown. And it also allows them to have the 12 restaurant seats that were already in there stay in place because somewhere along the line, these 12 restaurant seats were allowed and the paperwork got lost, but nobody's really sure how.
So the employee housing is going to be written into the permit. Could we see this as like could this become a trend in town? Are people talking about that?
It is. I think it should be. In fact, I was at a planning board meeting last night where the Gulf Station is also looking to put employee-style housing above its store. and that's on Bradford Street. So I guess it is a trend. And it's pretty nice because the owners of this building say they really wanted to do it because they own the building so they can. And they are conditioning, the selectmen are conditioning this economic development permit so that whoever buys the place next has to keep it as employee-style housing upstairs. The place is on the market right now for $1.3 million, and it's at 212 Bradford Street, so it's in the East End. And it is, it's like a little market that also has soup and sandwiches, and people do tend to go there and sit and talk, and it is the only place that far east that people can congregate.
Okay, Ann Wood of the Provincetown Banner, thanks for filling us in.
Hey, take care. Bye.
You too. Barry Stringfellow is joining us from the Martha's Vineyard Times newsroom. He's been hanging on patiently. Thank you, Barry. Good morning.
Morning, Sean.
Good morning to you. So it was around this time last year that winter storm Nico hit the island. And now why are we talking about that again?
Last month, yeah.
Last month, excuse me.
What happened was the predicted power outages happened. There was about 8,000 people without power. And about 6:30 that night, we received a call from a woman looking for a warming shelter. Up Island is particularly hit hard, and according to the Eversource outage map, Aquinnah was 100% without power. So we started making calls, and we called police, and we called fire, and we were referred to various places and churches, and we either got an answer to go somewhere else, or we got answering machines. So we didn't call Tisbury because, according to the Eversource map, there were no outages, and that turned out to be incorrect as well.
Huh.
Eventually, we got a hold of the Aquinnah Emergency Management Director from the number on the website, and he said that the old town hall was open and that it was warm and it had food and water. The next day, we got an email saying the town hall was never opened. And looking into that became an interesting series of miscommunications, and it turned out that the Aquinnah Emergency Management Director was in Michigan at the time, and he had had a conversation with the town manager. They had a misunderstanding about it being stocked, and it basically raised a red flag among the emergency managers on the island who have already expressed concern, but it really brought things to light. That the island is really unprepared and the system is in disarray, and that's a word that one of the management people from West Tisbury said. There aren't enough trained volunteers by Red Cross standards to open a shelter in each town. And because Dukes County is not recognized as a sovereign entity, it doesn't get support from FEMA or MEMA. So a town can get a grant, but the county cannot. Hmm. And the county emergency management is set up so the towns have to come to them. They have made a little progress. They have a draft memorandum of understanding about Oak Bluff School being a regional shelter, and each town said they would chip in $300. It's just really shed a light on the concerns of the emergency management people who have said that, these are part-time or volunteer people, and the island historically is unable to do anything in a regional way. And here we are, an island in the North Atlantic, sitting in a hurricane corridor. And as one of the emergency managers said, we have to make some progress. We're on borrowed time. It's only a matter of time before we have a Sandy. And they're all advocating for a one-person, full-time job to pull this all together.
Wow. Bit of a wake-up call around storm preparation thanks to some really good community journalism reporting. Thank you, Barry Stringfellow, Martha's Vineyard Times. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Sean.
Okay. Jeff Spillane is here from the Cape Cod Times. Jeff, let's talk about a local physician, a local doctor who himself has a terminal illness. He is going in front of a judge in a right-to-die case.
It is a right-to-die case for the terminally ill, Sean. This was heard this Wednesday up in Suffolk Superior Court in the city up in Boston. This Dr. Roger Klippler of Falmouth has prostate cancer. He wants to be able, should he desire, to take his own life if he becomes terminally ill, certainly something that we've heard about for years. And the crux of this court case, from what we can gather here, is his attorney is arguing that the state law should be interpreted for murder and manslaughter in a way that would protect doctors who prescribe a life-ending drug to an ill patient at their request, and that should be free from prosecution. And this lawsuit was brought on by an organization called Compassion and Choices, and it was against the Mass AG's office, Maura Haley's office, and the Cape and Islands District Attorney's office. Yeah. And during some of the arguments that were heard Wednesday at Suffolk Superior Court, both attorneys for the Mass AG and Cape and Islands DA said, you know, this may not be in our court, might be better suited for the legislature to take it up. Because really, they don't deal with hypothetical cases. So
right. So they're saying there is no case in front of us of a doctor being charged with murder or manslaughter.
Mm-hmm.
So let the legislature change the law.
That's right. That's right.
But
that's
then right. You got to wait till someone's up and threatening to go to prison before you take a look at the issue in the courts. I guess that's what they're saying. But the judge didn't rule on that yet, right?
He did not. She did not rule on that yet. No. And it should also be noted that the doctor with prostate cancer here from Falmouth has got a little bit of good news that his cancer seems to be decreasing. So,
oh wow, that is good news.
Yeah.
We did a feature. Catherine did a feature for WCAI about him and his issue. He sounds like a very interesting guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Let's move on to a shared treatment wastewater treatment plan that's being talked about between Yarmouth, Dennis, and Harwich to see if they can take a regional approach to wastewater.
That's right. And you know what? This is something that the folks that were working together on that Section 208 water quality plan and report for the Cape over the course of the past few years, this is exactly what they were looking for. Harwich, Dennis, and Yarmouth have been speaking about regionalizing their wastewater needs to save some money. There's an economy of scale involved here. You know, you build one treatment plant instead of three, so all the towns are going to benefit. They're going to save some money. And really, this is the kind of thinking that that needs to be happening here on the Cape as we move forward with this major wastewater issue.
Right.
But Yarmouth and Harwich would be sending their wastewater to a plant in South Dennis, should this come to pass. And so the amount of money that these towns would be saving is just phenomenal. I think they're it's about $706 million that can be saved by going through this regional process. Mm-hmm. And this, as I said, it became a priority after the 208 plan had been developed in 2015. We really need to focus on removing the nitrogen from the Cape Cod watersheds, and this is a great way to do it.
They any time frame on that?
What they are saying is as soon as possible. There's no set time date, but. Right.
Yeah, well, as Barry was saying, Barry was saying it's hard to get all the island communities together on something. Regionalization on the Cape hasn't always been easy, but in some issues, it's been accomplished for sure.
It has. It says here, while many meetings lay ahead, town officials need to act as soon as possible.
Okay. So. Two animal stories we need to get to here. Let's start with the loons. Actually, so this was a shooting of a few loons?
It sounds like that. It's a little bit of a sad news from the Lower Cape. Police and the wildlife organizations are investigating, this environmental police, shootings of two loons in Eastham in February. And this is a concern because this species is declining in population. And wild care, which we had mentioned earlier in the show, is a wildlife facility,
treatment, rehabilitation,
some treatment hospital.
Yeah.
So every loon is important these days for the breeding population, and they're just not sure what happened here.
Shotgun didn't seem like
shotgun is what they're thinking now, but there's going to be a necropsy done at Tufts University. We should know at some point whether or not this was a malicious act or an accident. Should also be noted, gunshots are not the only thing that are endangering this species. They also suffer from their nests being taken out by water skis, jet skis, and ingesting lead from jigs and sinkers that are in the water because they're the birds, kind of birds that dive down. So got to keep an eye out for these loons.
And it's always so shocking when we have these stories about people deliberately hurting and killing animals, particularly in this, in this region where that's one of the reasons people move here and live here and visit here, is to see the wildlife and be surrounded by it. Well, let's hope they get a break in that case, and anyone listening who might have insight could go to the police and talk to them about it if you have something to say.
That'd be terrific.
Let's talk about another animal story. This one a little bit happier.
It is. This is a real happy ending, Sean. And, you know, for anybody who's a dog owner like you and I are, this really touched you over the course of the past 3 weeks. Lioness is a 7-year-old Newfoundland from Sandwich. She went missing while her parents were away, and she was with a babysitter, a dog sitter.
Now, this is a Newfoundland, as you
said.
That's a big dog, right? It's like a bear.
She's a big girl. She was 115 pounds. So, obviously, her owners came back, launched a major effort to find her. Cape Cod Times had done a story about Lioness missing. They hired pet trackers. They had drones in the air. They had community outreach. There's a GoFundMe page, not so much for that, but to help bring in some of this technology needed to find her. And you'll never believe what lured Lioness into a cage to be found. A snack.
Do you know what snack it was?
I don't know what snack it was, but there was a cage set up behind the Oak Ridge School in Sandwich, a cage where she wouldn't be hurt. And she came in looking for a snack, and the cage door closed, and there she is. She's home. Lost about 20 pounds. The veterinarian says her coat and her feet pads look good, but she did have a lot of ticks. And the owner said, I wish she could tell us the story of what she did for 3 weeks.
Mm.
And if she decides to talk, I want to be the first one to interview her.
Well, so, when we talked about this story before, they talked about the reporter had spoken to an expert. And the expert said that after a few days, mm-hmm. the dog goes pretty much feral. So even
yeah.
if it's a family member right mm-hmm. there calling, it may not recognize because it's in survival
mode. They're in survival mode, exactly. And exactly. So that's what happened with her. And they also warned, a lot of people were out there saying, how can we help? And they said, you really don't try to go after her. She's shy. She'll be in this feral mode. Best thing you can do is just let us know where you saw her.
Reminds me of that Brady Bunch episode when they were looking for Tiger. the whole community is out there.
The whole community was out there.
Well, I was so happy to read about Lioness.
Me too.
And Lioness was found right before we had that cold. You know, the weekend got pretty cold last week. And I think Lioness was pretty lucky. We've had some pretty mild weeks here while she was on the run.
Yep, she was found Friday night right before that chill came in.
Jeff Spillane coming in the snow this morning from the Cape Cod Times newsroom, where he'll be returning, I guess, to continue his work today. Thank you, Jeff.
Well, thank you so much.
We spoke with Sam Houghton from the Mashpee Enterprise as well. Sarah Brown called in from the Vineyard Gazette. Tim Wood we spoke to from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Jim Deruta, the New Bedford Standard Times. Ann Wood from the Provincetown Banner. We also spoke with Barry Stringfellow from the Martha's Vineyard Times. I'm Sean Corcoran. I hope you support your local journalists. They're out there doing the work, sitting in the meetings, and gathering the information that you would gather yourself if you had the time. So let's support local journalism, and thank you for listening.
The Friday News Roundup is produced by Sean Corcoran. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.